Welcome to the Over My Dead Body podcast, episode 20. I'm your host, Alex Liddington Cox, a former journalist and foreign correspondent with News Limited and Schwartz Media. You might also have seen my work with Financial Times, ABC, Channel 10, SBS, Startup Daily, Mumbrella, and YouTube. You're listening to Over My Dead Body or OMDB podcast. You can find us anywhere you get your podcast. Just search OMDB podcast. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook with the same handle. I've been doing a deep dive on Andrew Tate lately.
If you're out here as a man and you have no battle in your life, no conquest in your life, no form of war in your life, then what you do? Every woman wants a boxer or a cage fighter. Of course you do.
Like, well, biologically, yes, because it means that, like, if you know, for me, everything is evolution, right?
Completely. So every woman wants a boxer or a cage fighter, but this is the testament to the problem of the modern world, right?
Right.
Every single man watching this knows that women want fighters. Every single man watching this would love to be able to say he's a fighter, but 99% of the men watching this will not go fight because they are afraid. You're all a bunch of pussies. They are pussies, all of them. That's all they are, they're pussies. And women can smell that. So if you want to have a woman who truly respects you, you need to put yourself through war in some form.
All right, calm down, Andrew. But the central idea that men are ignoring their evolutionary urges when they seek to become involved, progressive dads isn't new. I know I've caught myself on father's leave or the umpteenth time doing a load of laundry or ferrying the kids across town and thought, man, would a wolf put up with this shit? Wouldn't he be, like, killing his prey while trying to find a lone wolfette to have some wolf sex on the side with? Well, today we'll be speaking with the author of Wild Fathers, which documents the behavior of fathers across the animal kingdom. The message from which was pretty clear to me. You're not a pussy. You're a dad in good genetic company. So there's a lot to cover, the entire animal kingdom, in fact. Well, at least half of it. So let's get into it. But first, I give you the Oaks. Erin of Olraven was born in the Netherlands and moved to Australia via Spain in the 1980s. She has worked in zoos for more than three decades, including a senior curator at Taronga Zoo in Sydney for 20 years, where she was responsible for the scientific management of 400 species, including genetics, taxonomy, behaviour, welfare, interpretation, and research. In 2021, Erna published her book Wild Fathers, which detailed her decades of observations about males across the animal kingdom to push back against some of the cliches about gender roles and parenthood that we deal with today. Wild Fathers is one of seven books that Erna has published. She remains a leading consultant, lecturer, and thought leader in the industry, and she joins us today. Erna, thank you very much for joining Over My Dead Body.
It's great. I'm looking forward to it.
I am too. Putting your zookeeper hat on, could you describe, in your industry terms, the shifting mating and parenting dynamics between men and women as this generation of fathers have played a greater role in raising the children and women's workforce participation has increased?
Well, as we know, we all understand that all of life is about getting your genes into the next generation. All species on Earth try to do that as efficiently, as effectively, and time-wise with as little time consumption from either party. So both of them try to push as much as possible of the responsibility onto the other sex, really. But in mammals, it's very interesting that because women come with the mammary glands, they also carry the babies internally. So, you know, you can't really outsource that particular part. It's become very few mammals actually have active paternal here. Only 5% of all mammals on the planet have some kind of paternal care. What I see in humans is changing as women got reliable contraceptive. The second wave of feminism got women into the workforce. So when we then took at balancing time, who's got time and who's got energy, it had to shift as a result of that, because there are things that can be done by fathers, such as, the reliable bottles of milk now. They can change nappies, they can do all of those things once the baby is born, at least. Obviously, the gestation is still internal and largely a female activity, and probably will remain so for in the foreseeable future.
All men would hope so.
So what you see in the animals is that the labor division, in order to get those genes to the next generation, varies an awful lot. If animals can get away with, slam bam, thank you, ma'am, and impregnating someone, then that's what they'll do. If it means that the babies are at risk by doing that because the female can't do it all on their own, then the male will also participate to the level that is required in order to successfully raise those babies. And it's a balance. I mean, there are two ways, and perhaps, I'm a bit ahead of myself here. There are two ways mammal babies are born. You can either do the invest a lot into one offspring that's born, slightly more advanced perhaps, and you give it a lot of attention and care. Or you can have, very fast reproduction, and you throw out 8, 10 babies every time, and they're, if some of them make it, well, so be it. There's, we'll do it again in 3 months. So humans are obviously in the category of we're going to invest a lot of time in this one offspring. And over time, more help has been needed from fathers. I mean, already we have changed to involve fathers a lot more than the other great apes do.
And we'll get into some of those case studies as we go through this conversation, but I just wanted to perhaps take you back. Can you remember, was there a moment during your career as a zookeeper where you started to think, actually, some of the stories that we tell about males in the animal kingdom and the way that informs gender roles for humans doesn't quite match up 100% with what I'm seeing day to day?
Yeah. The variety of different temperaments, different roles, how caring some fathers are, how negligent others. There's a huge variety in the animal world. And it's very difficult to say that, well, we should be modeling ourselves on this one or that one. And in the book, I really took particular aspects of, some fathers are particularly good at this, some fathers are particularly good at that. As role models for particular fatherhood traits. It's there wasn't a particular moment. I think these things dawn on you, and I dealt with birds as well as mammals, and reptiles. And you don't see a lot of paternal care in reptiles, but you see nearly 90% of birds have some form of paternal care. And they are incredibly involved. They work terribly, terribly hard to get those young to hatch and then to fledge and hopefully live successfully thereafter. So you see some of the most amazing birds, male birds giving fantastic care to their offspring, some of them continuing after the mother dies to try and do it on their own. So you see amazing dedication. It's never. I've never really come to a conclusion about, how humans have had to change in more recent times as a result of the birds. It's been more human-induced, just knowing that all species have to do what it is to balance the energy to bring up baby.
You mentioned, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned birds. I think everyone's quite popularly aware of the movie March of the Penguins, and that is a very equal relationship between the parents in that movie. But an equal role, a more equal role between the parents, as you detail in your book, is broadly observable across like all species of birds. What is it about being a bird that encourages males to be more involved fathers?
The fact that both parents are needed to protect the nest, often to build the nest, to protect the nest from people, you know, other predators around who may like to eat the eggs or the hatchlings, and to find enough food to feed the brood needs both parents. So when both parents are needed in order to get survival rates up to a certain level, then both parents are involved.
When it comes to the burden of raising children, the resources that are required to raise children, the financial resources and the time resources that are required to raise children nowadays, you know, anecdotally seem to be a lot higher. And also the standards that women are holding their prospective mates to is also being held higher because of reproductive technologies allow them to do it by themselves if they can't find a partner that fits their, you know, that fits their standards. How would you process that through a zoologist's eye?
I think the standards of mate that any female animal or human takes on board, the standards have always been high. I mean, there's something that Darwin already talked about, the sexual selection. You choose your mate as the sire of the offspring for particular reasons. And that is, we want good fit genes. So we are programmed to seek the fittest male we can find to impregnate the female to have the healthiest baby she can. You want good genes, but then you also want good resources. So animals like, for example, orangutans, female orangutans, the male and the females are promiscuous, but she will try and live in a territory of a male with good resources. Now, in other great apes, gorillas are very protective, you know, to hold him up as a model of what human fatherhood should be like. He would be more like the Victorian father. Male gorillas are amazing. They're incredibly protective. They take all the stress for everyone. They make sure no predators can get to their offspring or their females.
You detail this rather remarkable story of, I think it's a gorilla that you dedicated the book to. Where one of the females in his little enclosure was freaking out. I think it was an environment change, and she just started ignoring one of their children, and he just walked up to her and put her hand on her back or something like that.
Yeah. That was they moved from the Netherlands as a group, and we had zookeepers fly to the Netherlands to get to know them, so that they would know all the personalities. Zookeepers from the Netherlands came with them to help them settle in. But when they came out of there, they've got amazing crates. Like if you ever, you know, if you can't afford to fly business class, go in a gorilla crate. It's very comfortable. So the mothers were in individual crates with their babies, and the juveniles were in individual crates, and the male was in an individual crate. So they had just been released from their transport crate. And one of the females, Frala, I think it was, just freaked out. She was just, you know, a bit beside herself. She's a nervy type. And she dropped, but she didn't drop. She put her baby on the ground and wasn't looking after him at all. At that stage, she still should have been a babe in arms at all times. And Kibabu, the male, just calmly walked up to her and put a hand on her back, and then slowly pushed her towards where the baby is and sort of pushed her down to, like, there's your responsibility, pick him up now. And she did. Like, just his gesture was enough to settle her, like, okay, he's still in charge. I know what to do. I will follow his instructions. Female gorillas don't have a lot of autonomy. They really are reliant on being told by the male what to do. And he did his job. He realized that the situation was out of hand, and he immediately he did something to rectify it, and it was successful.
Demonstrated an emotional intelligence. Now, granted, as you say, this is a Victorian era sort of standard that that gorillas are living up to. Let's look at some examples that are a little bit more, even more challenging. Marmosets, which is a species that I was only really vaguely aware of. The relationship dynamics of marmosets are quite fascinating. Could you just explain them?
Yeah, so they also fall in the polygamy category, but in this case it's called polyandry. So one female has at least two males usually, and they do all the baby care. So as soon as she gives birth, they will carry the babies. Neither of them really knows whether he's the father or not, but they do love babies. They just love them. They see a baby and they want to hold it. And they would take it back to the mother to have something to drink. So whenever there's lactation required, they go back to the mother. What that does, I mean, they live, she's quite depleted. They often have twins. So she needs to build up energy. If she was also carrying around those babies, it would be much harder for her to feed and build back up her condition and eat enough to lactate sufficiently to bring those babies through. So from an evolutionary perspective, those males are choosing to support those babies that are born on the chance that it is theirs. And by doing that, they may get their genes into the next generation. So, but they're marmosets and tamarins love babies. I mean, those males are programmed to see a baby, melt, and want to hold it. There was a great story told to me by one of the zookeepers in Auckland Zoo, where no, it was Wellington Zoo in New Zealand, I think. The father died whilst the female was pregnant. They brought in another male. They put them together. He would have very well known it wasn't his. Within an hour of those babies being born, he was out there. He was looking after them. He just did everything he had to protect them, to care for them. He did all the right things. And also the female trusted him. So in zoos, we're very careful that we don't move young males, tamarins and marmosets in particular, before they have witnessed births in their group and have learned from other males how to do it. There's such a learning curve involved in that. And that's in all primates, males and females, and often in all mammals. First-time parents of all types are usually really rubbish at it. And that's really interesting because humans now only have one or two. So there's not a lot of practice. And we certainly see in the animals, the more offspring they have, the better they get at the raising. I've seen animals like tigers give birth and, something pops out at the back end and they jump up like, holy moly, what was that? And actually frightened of it, like not knowing what to do. So it's first-time parenthood is not a natural thing, even for animals.
That's something I definitely that resonates with me. We've talked a little bit about a couple of terms that I'd like to dive down into with some recent examples. So we talk about certain animals being monogamous and certain animals being promiscuous. And I think I glean from your book that humans would be considered monogamous with a shade of promiscuity. I think I've got that correct. What's your reaction to the book Sex at Dawn, which is written by a guy called Christopher Ryan, although he co-wrote it with somebody who leans quite heavily on the example of chimpanzees being promiscuous to push back on the idea that humans can be successfully monogamous?
Yeah, so there's certainly something in it. I mean, we come from the same family line. We have ancestors in common with chimpanzees and bonobos and orangutans and gorillas. And we were last on that same family line with the bonobos and the gorillas. They're all promiscuous. So we changed. So at some stage during the lives of our ancestors in deep history, we started walking upright. And in starting to walk upright, our legs had to fit below our hips, and that narrowed the birth canal at the same time. We also started to do a lot more communal hunting. We started making tools a lot more for hunting and other things, and we started communicating. All of those things required a bigger brain. Now, if you combine a bigger brain with a smaller birth canal, you can see that, you know, we're heading for trouble. So most scientists agree that it is at that stage that it became more advantageous for our species to have fathers directly involved. I mean, there's still the whole thing about, you know, it takes a village to raise raise a baby, but fathers became very important at that point, because for our babies to fit through that narrow birth canal, they're born very premature. So our babies, if they were another, you know, if a primate, a gorilla or a bonobo gave birth to a baby of the stage ours are, when we call them full term, they'd be embryonic. So in order to be born as advanced as a chimpanzee, women would have to be pregnant for another 12 months. So, I mean, these babies come out and they cling to their mother immediately. I mean, they can even stand on their legs a bit. Mama's swinging through the trees and baby hangs on. Try that with a human baby that's 4 days old.
Yeah, and if women had to be pregnant for 2 years, the push presence would be enormous.
That's right.
So many, just wanted to shift it to another example in your book. Many men's rights activists invoke animals like a wolf, for instance, as a creature that embodies these quote unquote male characteristics of strength, aggression, and procreation. How accurately are they representing the animal like a wolf?
Yeah, wolves are like that, but both males and females have those characteristics. The male is particularly...
If I was confronted by a female wolf, I don't think I'd be like, oh, it's a female wolf, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine.
That's right. Both males and females have those same characteristics. They're both brave, they're both strong, they're both great hunters, and she's the one that gives birth and he brings the food. Now, something about the wolf that is absolutely admirable is that when she's in the den with, you know, some puppies, she can't go and find food for herself. So he drags back, you know, a leg of whatever, antelope or whatever he can find to the den so that she can feed. So he's great. You know, he's doing a wonderful job.
Wolves are monogamous. I don't think most guys would really know that.
Yep, they are. They are. They are till death do us part. So if one of the partners dies, the other one will try to pair up again and keep breeding if that is possible. But yeah, they are monogamous, and they are in a very, very small percentage of monogamous mammals. But when it comes to those attributes that are supposedly particularly gendered, you know, what were the ones you mentioned? Aggression, brave, all of that. The females are just as brave, just as aggressive, but they are good fathers. And what they do, they are good role models. Both parents are good role models. And in a lot of animals that do have paternal care for their offspring, fathering role modeling is really important. And I think that is particularly so in humans. I mean, you know, I'm not a sociologist. I know animal stuff. But I think everybody knows that, you know, fathers that are absent in poor communities in America, the juveniles have higher percentages in jail. You know, there are all of those statistics around when there are absent fathers. There's probably more involved than the absence of the father. There's probably poverty. There's probably poor education. There are probably other things that roll into that. You know, the fathers might also have grown up with domestic violence. The mothers might have grown up in domestic violence, etc. So there's more going on than that. But certainly, in the back to the gorillas, this Kibabu I knew was just the most amazing role model, because he gorillas are like 200 kilos. The females are like 70. So you see that in a lot of polygamous animals, the males are a lot bigger. And also, when it turns around, when it's polyandry, the females are usually bigger than the males. There's probably something in there with, you know, physical domination. You know, just by your sheer size, you're a little bit more intimidating when you want people to follow what you're telling them to do. But Kibabu was a very gentle leader. Gorillas can be intimidating and violent. He was just intimidating. If there were any squabbles between his females, he would just have to look at them and raise an eyebrow, and they would go, "Oh, okay, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're all good. We're all good. We're all friends." And particularly that gentleness was what I appreciated was being passed on to his male offspring. So his male offspring went on to be very good breeding males in other zoos because of their gentleness. They didn't use physical strength to dominate. They have the respect of their family group, and that's how they were the CEO of the family party.
So, just dovetailing on that, what's your reaction to, men's rights activists characterizing men as evolutionarily motivated to behave a certain way?
Yeah, well, I'd like them to read as much about the chimpanzees as they have about the bonobos in that case. So they're the two species that we're most related to. When people talk about men being aggressive or violent and that just being normal because that's the way we've evolved, they need to look at our two primate cousins. And the bonobos are female-led, they're very egalitarian. They have very peaceful societies. Older females are in charge. They share food very carefully between all of the members of the group. And those males rank lower than any of the females in the group. So, you know, those two species only separated a couple of million years ago as the Congo River went through that area about 2 million years ago. Chimpanzees remained on the north side and bonobos on the south side, and they then evolved into the two separate species they are now. Female bonobos, it is postulated, became female-led to prevent infanticide. And that is the case in nearly all female-led societies in the animal world. I guess comparing yourself to one species and saying, well, that's where we get it, so therefore it's totally normal. But equally related, we are to bonobos, where the males cower whenever the females say, you know, you're out of line. We are somewhere in between. They are the yin and yang of our closest relatives, and I think we can learn lessons from both of them. I mean, chimpanzees are very good at conflict resolution. They are quick off the mark. You know, they react to most things with violence. Bonobos react to most things with sex. We probably should be aware that neither of those are the right solution in most cases, particularly in the workplace. But we have something to learn from each one of them. If we want to model ourselves on one over the other, I'd say from the bonobos, where the society is egalitarian, peaceful, and more empathetic and kind, perhaps I'd look in that direction first.
Erna Volraven, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's been fun.
Really psyched to have Erna on the show. I just wanted to play another clip of what men are like according to a popular internet figure.
He's like the male bowerbird building something beautiful so the female will approve of it. And it's motivation, you know, and that's something that I think modern women don't really understand about men. They don't understand that, at least to the degree that males are uncorrupted and not bitter because of being rejected, they're doing everything they can to kneel before the eternal image of the feminine.
What modern women don't understand, Jordan, I don't have the faintest clue what you're talking about. I do know that most birds that you're referring to do have really intimately shared parenting responsibilities. Just a thought. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. We'll be back on the last day of the month with our second Sit Rep episode where I'll give you a rundown of all the dad news. For now, though, my name's Alex Lidington Cox. Have a good one. Yeah.